Hello there. Today is Tuesday, January 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, thousands of troops are on their way to the Middle East as Iran promises strong retaliation for the killing of a top general.
Found himself in somewhat of a shock, one because his number one leader was lost, because I don't think he expected that.
Congress returns to Washington as the stalemate over an impeachment trial continues. Also ahead, Elton John winning big at the Golden Globe Awards on Sunday. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump's confrontation with Iran is posing a gut check for Congress, brazenly testing whether the House and Senate will exert their own authority over U.S. military strategy or cede more war powers to the White House. As tensions rise at home and abroad, Speaker Nancy Pelosi will hold House votes this week to limit Trump's ability to engage Iran militarily after the surprise U.S. airstrike that killed General Qasem Soleimani. A Senate vote is also expected to follow after that. Ahead of the attack that killed the Iranian general, the president did not consult with congressional leaders. Joining us now to talk more about the attack and the killing is Bill Parker, Chief Operating Officer at the East-West Institute. Thank you for being with us, sir. What do you think of the decision the president made to take this man out?
There's really two leaders that were taken out there, and there's not a whole lot of discussion about the leader of Qatar, Hezbollah, who's also a significant player in this. But the reality is that there have been significant numbers of terrorist activities against Americans and the West over the years, and these two individuals in particular led many of those or designed many of those, and by all accounts were continuing to plan for future attacks, and therefore the opportunity was there. And I think it would maybe was more than just an intelligence opportunity. In other words, more than just we have the guy in our sights and we're gonna hit him, but maybe a political statement as well on the larger.
Is it going to make things better, or will they get worse first?
You know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just testified on the Hill, as you know, that 17% of all the attacks in Iraq were based in some way through Iran. That makes it 608 deaths there alone of American soldiers. There have been numerous other attempts and successes against U.S. military and U.S. civilians through the time, to include the rocket attack that just killed a civilian contractor recently. So this is not something that is just a one-off strike. It is actually a response to something that happened where we lost Americans. And then on top of that, you had the large number of Iranians backed by and directed by this individual that Soleimani, and said, okay, the time is now to take him out. So I think that was more of the geostrategic thought of this. Of those individuals that are planning to attack Americans need to be held responsible for it, and that's where that came from.
Is it going to stop the plans, or are new people just going to be taking over?
Well, I think that you will always have a new group of bad people, and whether you're talking about ISIS or you're talking about nation states or non-state actors, you're always going to have people that want to do bad things to good people. And in this particular case, I think that you will have more planning take place. I think that you have Khamenei, who has found himself in somewhat of a shock, one, because his number one leader was lost. Two, because I don't think he expected that to happen. And so he has to figure out what his response is going to be. And that can be a very wide breadth of responses, anywhere from terrorism, which he certainly has lots of capability throughout the globe, to cyber attacks, again, very capable of that, to other potentially political activities. One thing that you're seeing right now is the political activity that's going on inside Iran, where now, at this moment, you have people that are supporting, in the short term, the administration there, but I don't think that will last for very long because, as you know, over the past month or two, there was a lot of stress against the leadership in Iran as their finances and their economy were basically collapsing around them.
But it seems like now, from what we're seeing over here, that in some ways there's now a show of solidarity.
I think you will see that in the short term, but not in the long term. I think that the economic impact that is struck is significant, and you will see that transition back to the bigger picture. Iranian people are very well educated, and you can tell are getting fed up with the internal leadership of their country. So you started to see a lot of stress put on the country. You saw for the first time in many years effigies of leadership being burned over there, of their own leadership, lots of protests going on in the cities, et cetera. So I think you will continue to see that happen as we move forward here. But for the short term, you have a pause where you have a publicly directed outcry for this individual.
We're sending thousands of troops over there now in light of what's happening. What can the U.S. expect to come from any sort of retaliatory actions from Iran? And if we then retaliate from their retaliation, where does this all end?
I think there's a bigger point to be discussed here than just what is the next tit for tat going to be. And looking beyond it to what is the diplomatic off-ramp? Is there an off-ramp right now? Is there some diplomatic initiative that's being undertaken so that we don't continue to escalate, but in fact begin to de-escalate? Is that a possibility? I think the answer is yes. And there are various possibilities. I mean, the reality is it is not in the interest of either the United States or of Iran to go to war with each other. I mean, certainly at the end of the day, if you just look at forces alone, the United States is significantly more capable. With that said, there will still be loss of life on both sides, and I don't think anybody really wants that. So how do you step away from this? How do you step away from this escalation that we have right now towards something else? And I think that is the bigger question of not what is the next tit for tat going to be, but what is that diplomatic off-ramp to get us to a more stable environment? There are a lot of opportunities out there. I think that you have things as simple as incidents at sea agreement that you and I have talked about on this show before. I think that you have the opportunity to talk about de-escalation of issues between the Saudis and the Iranians. I think you have issues specifically between Saudi and Yemen and the Houthis. So how do you de-escalate? Well, you do it one step at a time, and at the same time not escalate and say, okay, we will not go after another target. You will not go after another target. Let's start figuring out how to walk this thing back. And to me, that really is the major question here. It's not what is going to be the next minor strike. I don't think there's going to be a major strike by either side, but minor strike. And then how do we start walking this thing back to the point that we don't have major conflict happening.
All right, Bill Parker, Chief Operating Officer at the East-West Institute. Meanwhile, human rights groups and several U.S. lawmakers are demanding answers after dozens of Iranian Americans were held for questioning at the U.S.-Canada border over the weekend, coinciding with the sharp rise in tensions between Washington and Tehran. Nagar Hekmati says she is speaking out about the selective way she and other Iranian Americans were treated at the border after being held for 5 hours this weekend.
It's not okay. And for me as an immigrant, I'm used to it, unfortunately. But for my kids, it shouldn't be okay. And I'm afraid that's a slippery slope.
Well, Jorge Barón with the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project says Customs and Border Patrol denies it, but he observed discriminatory screening of Iranian Americans and families at the border in Blaine, Washington.
It is clear that there was a pattern of subjecting people who were born in Iran to additional questioning and being held, in my opinion, detained because they were not entitled to leave this location until they experienced additional questioning, which we believe is completely inappropriate.
The Washington State chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations says it assisted more than 60 Iranians and Iranian Americans of all ages who were detained for as long as 11 hours and questioned by U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents. Here are some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. Europe and NATO are urging restraint as Iran pledges revenge for the U.S. attack. Turkey has started a military deployment in Libya as international pressure rises there. A U.S. startup is producing imitation coffee, and it's beanless. And Ukrainian cuisine is delighting in the heart of North Dakota. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A U.S. Congress returns to Washington this week. The stalemate over how to conduct an impeachment trial in the Senate continues. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has so far refused to send over the articles of impeachment without assurances that this will be a fair process. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he doesn't want witnesses to testify. He will work closely with the president's legal team, and he believes it will ultimately end in an acquittal for the president. Meanwhile, former National Security Advisor John Bolton said Monday he is willing to testify in the expected Senate impeachment trial of the president, which is a pretty surprising development that could potentially strengthen the case that the president should be removed from office. This as a top White House aide who may have witnessed the events that prompted the House to impeach Trump in December. Joining us now to talk all about what we can expect ahead is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, joining us now live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Jack, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you again.
All right, so you heard John Bolton wouldn't testify in the House investigation because the president basically was blocking it due to what he called was executive privilege, even after being subpoenaed. Now, why is he willing, do you think, in the Senate when it's unclear if they'll even allow witnesses?
Yeah, it's a really interesting response. I mean, when we look at Ambassador Bolton, he's always been a bit of a wild card, no matter when he was working at the UN, when he was, again, National Security Advisor, or just about any time else in his career. So I look back at conversations I have had with him directly, and I think back to some of the things I've heard him say in the past. So, again, nothing shocks me with the ambassador. He has said some outlandish things in the past, and apparently it's something that he enjoys doing and tweaking everybody in the room when he does it.
Do you think he actually would, or do you think he's doing it because they're saying they're not calling witnesses?
Well, actually, one part of this is that they're suggesting that it appears that he has a book coming out relatively soon as well. And because of that, that may be a part of this. But if we think back, his lawyers earlier on, even while the House was going through the investigatory process, they were talking about some of the things that he knew directly. And if you take a look at what some of the witnesses said, in fact, they referred to Ambassador Bolton himself saying, look, Ambassador Bolton himself said that there were issues going on here. Ambassador Bolton talked about what Mulvaney was doing, about what some of the other players, what Mike Pence was doing, and others in the room. And so I think there have been a lot of people who are very interested with what he has to say because he really was in the center of the whirlwind. And a lot of people want to understand what that means.
All right. Well, Senator Lindsey Graham, meanwhile, who is now a staunch ally of the president, is threatening to start the trial in the Senate without the articles of impeachment if Nancy Pelosi doesn't turn them over. How is that possible?
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful question as well. Again, you know, in so many ways, this is uncharted territory. But essentially what Senator Graham is talking about is this idea of changing the rules, because technically the Senate has the right to change the rules, saying that 51%, so in other words, a majority have to change the rules. However, at the same time, I don't think that's actually going to work. And the reason is that regardless of anything else, this is still a legal proceeding. And what we have right now is the Senate doesn't actually have the articles. That's actually still being held by the House. There's something called jurisdiction. And what jurisdiction essentially means is we have the right to look at this issue because it's kind of ours. Well, what we have right now is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court who's going to be presiding over this. I think that there could be a jurisdiction question if the Senate tries to move forward before they actually have the articles themselves. And I think that's the problem they're going to face.
Right. Nancy Pelosi doesn't seem like she's worried at all about it. I mean, this could just go on, I assume.
Well, it could. And I think that's what the concern from the Senate perspective is. Do you want this to be shrouding over everything else that's going on right now? Of course, and I know that you were just reporting on what's going on in Iran. And that issue, while having nothing to do with the impeachment at all, certainly impacts the process itself because there are members of the Senate saying we need to move this forward. We want this to be a dead issue by the time the election starts. At the same time, you're looking at Nancy Pelosi in the House, and Democrats who are saying this is a very real issue, and this issue should be alive, not just now, in a week and in a month. And if we can keep this going all the way into November, then we have something to talk about.
All right. Well, we always appreciate your perspective. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice joining us live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Well, Sunday's attack by the Somali extremist group al-Shabaab on a Kenyan military base was aimed at scoring propaganda points, according to some experts. But they also say the assault shows the region needs robust cooperation to defeat extremists. Authorities say three U.S. personnel were killed and several aircraft and military vehicles destroyed during the attack on the base, which hosts joint U.S. and Kenyan forces in the coastal region of Lamu. VOA correspondent Mariana Diallo reports.
Gunfire could be heard in video taped several kilometers away from Kenya's Manda Bay airfield. Attackers breached the heavily secured base at dawn, but were pushed back. Five jihadists were killed, according to Kenya's army spokesperson. Three Americans were also killed in the attack, among them 23-year-old army specialist Henry Mayfield Jr.
Break my heart. You see people and you... I just saw him this summer. You know, it just, I don't have words to say. It's just breaking my heart.
Matt Bryden, an analyst at the Sahan Research and Development Organization, says it was a bold attack.
I think we might see a threat that could bifurcate or move in one of two ways. Either this is an indication of al-Shabaab's intent to continuously strike Kenya, something we know that they do intend to do, or it could be also an indication of al-Shabaab's determination now to strike American targets.
But the damage caused by the attack was exaggerated by the group, says Kenyan security expert Mustafa Ali.
It's a daring attack by al-Shabaab to ostensibly to score some propaganda points so that it can use that for propaganda purposes in Somalia and around the world.
Al-Shabaab has been launching regular cross-border raids since Kenya sent troops into Somalia in 2011 as part of an African Union force to protect the internationally backed government, which the jihadists have been trying to overthrow for more than a decade. Kenya, Bryden says, needs more help.
And unless we see better cooperation across the region, then Kenya is going to remain vulnerable. And it's al-Shabaab who has the initiative in being able to choose when to attack, what to attack, how to attack, and Kenya has to be able to block every one of those attacks, which of course is impossible.
The Lamu region, which includes the popular tourist destination Lamu Island, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, lies close to the Somali border and has suffered frequent attacks. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, cooler temperatures and rain Monday brought some relief from the fires that firefighters have been battling for weeks in Australia. Tom Delamotte, senior forecaster for Australia's Bureau of Meteorology, says smoke from bushfires across Australia has blanketed the city of Melbourne.
We've seen easterly winds overnight, and that's brought the smoke from eastern Victoria into central parts, including the Melbourne area.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who's been sharply criticised for his handling of the fires, especially after travelling to Hawaii for a family vacation during the emergency, vowed on Monday to pay whatever it takes to help victims of the fires, which have burned millions of hectares across three states. He committed an extra $1.4 billion to a new fund that would help rebuild damaged homes and infrastructure, but said additional funds could be made available if needed.
I outlined today that this is an initial and additional investment of $2 billion. If more is needed and the cost is higher, then more will be provided.
An estimated 2,000 homes have been destroyed, and officials say even with this rain, it won't be enough to put out all the fires before hot, dry weather comes back this week. Joining us now to talk more about it is Frank Giozzo, Professor of Climate and Energy Policy at the Australian National University. Thanks for being with us. So there have been a lot of implications to what's happening with these horrific fires, as well as how your prime minister has dealt with the crisis, including his refusal to acknowledge climate change is real. How big of a problem has that been, and how it's been dealt with?
So the bushfire crisis is turning out to be something really massive for Australia. A very large number of people are directly affected, and many, many others really have it shown to them just how important nature is for our well-being. And that comes back to climate change policy. The present Conservative government has been avoiding any kind of policy action responding to climate change, but public opinion will very clearly be affected by this. There will be, once again, a stronger emphasis on responding to climate change, and we may ultimately see that reflected in Australian politics on climate change. It is an opportunity for government to pivot on this.
How do you see things changing when this is all said and done? Because you're only halfway through the summer, and this doesn't look like it's ending anytime soon. There's a lot of destruction. I'm sure this is going to have enormous economic ramifications.
Yeah, that's right. Right now, we're, of course, concerned about minimizing the loss of life and minimizing the loss of property. We're heading for several thousand homes destroyed in Australia overall, and dozens of people have already lost their lives. The longer-term fallout is in terms of infrastructure rebuild, housing rebuild, but also in terms of an enormous loss to the Australian agricultural industry, so significant stock losses in terms of plants and agricultural growing areas. Tourism will also take a hit, and so there will also be the extent in terms of rebuilding structure in a way that is better able to withstand future bushfire crisis and aspects of climate change. And so these are the kinds of things that really drive it home to policymakers as well as to members of the public that we do need to respond to climate change as it unfolds. Australia is really at the very forefront globally in terms of directly experiencing the impact from climate change as it begins to unfold.
So why do you think that the Australian government has been so reluctant to, you know, address climate change or to, you know, to deal with the impact of what's happening?
Yeah, so climate change has been a major political football in Australia for well over a decade. Several prime ministers have gained and then subsequently lost their jobs over the issue of climate change policy. And the reason for this is a great tension in Australia between, on the one side, the fact that we're a major fossil fuel producer. We're the largest exporter of coal in the world. We produce very large quantities of natural gas and ship that to East Asia. Very large industries, big export revenue earners, and of course governments are keen to protect that. And on the other hand, Australia really is in the firing line of climate change impacts, and so Australia has a very vital national interest for the world to do more to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and thereby ultimately limit the extent of highly adverse changes that we're seeing down here in Australia. And so that is playing out in the political arena, and is really very sharp conflict between these two objectives. Longer term, where we as researchers would see the future and where increasingly industry sees the future, is in a renewable energy economy for Australia. So Australia is among the best placed countries in the world for wind and solar-based industry, including at very large scales, large enough where Australia could perhaps produce 10, 20 times the amount of energy that we're using domestically and export all of that, and all of that could come from renewable energy sources. That's the economy of the future. But making that change, getting that investment in place, and somehow dealing with the transition in the old fossil fuel-based industry, that is what is politically so hard.
Has the government now talked about what comes next after this current crisis ends and about rebuilding and where to go from here to be better equipped to deal with this type of catastrophe?
So the discussion about what comes next and how we'll go about it is really just in its infancy. The government severely bungled its response at the start, tried to downplay the crisis, probably because it reminds people of climate change. And then just after Christmas, the government turned on this and did make it, as it should be, the absolute priority for the federal government. And so now we've just had a commitment for setting aside $2 billion Australian for the bushfire recovery fund, but that's really just the beginning. What we need is a very comprehensive rethink as to how we do our planning, how we assist rural communities in being prepared for natural disasters, how state and federal governments work together, and how we'll get it together to allocate very large amounts of funding, not just for the rebuild, but for being better prepared for these kinds of catastrophes in the future that will inevitably come on the fire.
All right. Well, we appreciate your coming on and talking to us all about it. That's Frank Jotso, Professor of Climate and Energy Policy at the Australian National University. The Golden Globe Awards Sunday night saw a lot of diversity. The AP's Margie Sarzaletta has more on the show and the awards, which are often seen as a precursor for the Oscars.
Among the winners for the Movie Acting Awards were Renee Zellweger, Joaquin Phoenix, and Brad Pitt. Among the TV Acting Award winners were Brian Cox, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Olivia Colman, and Rami Youssef, who joked he knows that no one has seen his show, Rami. Ricky Gervais hosted for the fifth time and had no plans for being invited back.
You'll be pleased to know this is the last time I'm hosting these awards, so I don't care anymore. I'm joking. I never did.
I'm Archie Zaraletta.
Well, one of Sunday's big winners was Awkwafina, who became the first American of Asian descent actor to win a Golden Globe in the Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy category. She won for her role in Lulu Wang's The Farewell.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
Manan is dying.
She doesn't know.
Here's her acceptance speech.
Thank you. If anything, if I fall upon hard times, we can sell this. So that's good. First of all, thank you so much to the Hollywood Foreign Press. I've never been in the Golden Globes, so I'm here now, and it's this, and it's great. I'd like to thank everyone at A24. Yes. Peter Seraph, Danny Malia, Big Beach, and Andrew Miano. I'd like to thank the woman who plays my grandma on The Farewell, Zhao Shuchen. Zhao Laosher. Thank you, and most importantly to Lulu Wang, our incredible director. You gave me this chance, the chance of a lifetime, and you taught me so much, and just filming the story, being with you is incredible. I'd like to dedicate this to my dad, Wally. I told you I'd get a job, Dad. And to my grandma, my best friend, the woman who raised me, to my mother, Tia, who I always hoped was watching from somewhere above, and I hope that she's watching now. Thank you all. Thank you.
All right, well, until last year, no Asian American woman had been nominated in that category. Last year, Constance Wu was nominated for her role in the 2018 film Crazy Rich Asians. Well, meanwhile, also at Sunday night's Golden Globe Awards, Elton John and his longtime writing partner, Bernie Taupin, beat out Taylor Swift and Beyoncé in their win for Best Original Song for I'm Gonna Love Me Again in the film Rocket Man. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a fantastic day.